Good evening. It's delightful to see a fairly large audience. Unfortunately, with science fiction, it's all too often a smaller audience, so I'm pleased to see you all here. I think we're in for a special treat tonight with David Wilson speaking on some of his writing, reading his short stories. He's a native of Grand Rapids, has schooled at University of Massachusetts, University of Liverpool, and is currently a doctoral student at MSU. And that's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. This is my latest book, Stranger on the Loose. Those of you who don't have a copy are probably not living life to the fullest. This is my first book, The Kafka Effect. I was going to, I'm thinking about reading a story out of that one, but it's a little racy. So we'll see what the tone of the audience is like before we get to that. I don't really have much to say about myself. I guess what I'll do is read some stories, and then afterwards we can do a little Q&A if you'd like, unless there are any introductory questions you might have for me. Okay. This is a collection of some longer stories and shorter stories, what some people call flash fiction, which are range from anywhere to a paragraph to a couple of pages long. I'm going to focus on some of the shorter fiction tonight so as not to bore you too much with the longer narratives. The first one I'm going to read is called The Groundhog That Didn't Know He Was a Man. There was a groundhog that didn't know he was a man. I stuck my mouth in his hole and tried to tell him what he didn't know, but he wouldn't listen. Go away, he mumbled. Fine, I replied. I ran into a nearby hotel and stole a mirror off the wall. A bellhop saw me out of the corner of his eye and started chasing me. During the chase, the groundhog that didn't know he was a man stuck his head out of his hole. He sniffed the air with his sharp aquiline nose and looked around with his wide blue eyes. People clapped. Some people threw their hands up in the air and said, "Hallelujah!" It wasn't Groundhog Day, but people were out and about anyway. Bellhop got caught in a revolving door. The moment he stepped into it, the door accelerated to 75 miles per hour and wouldn't let him out. I shook a finger at him as I blustered through a normal door, the big mirror awkwardly tucked beneath my armpit. Outside the hotel, the groundhog that didn't know he was a man was peacock prancing around his hole in a perfect circle, his chest thrust out, his arms akimbo, his knees gracefully jabbing at the sky. After his third revolution, people started to pass out. They were so happy. I said, "Stop encouraging him." The people that had passed out woke up and shook their heads no at me. Puckering up my lips at them, I dislodged the mirror from my armpit and held it out in front of the groundhog that didn't know he was a man. He saw his reflection and stopped peacock prancing. "Oh my," he said. He began to touch his naked body all over the place. He touched his nose and chin. He touched his nipples and love handles. He touched his elbows. He touched his belly button. "It's an outie," he hollered. He touched his genitals. He touched his thighs and his ankles and all 10 of his toes, one at a time. "See," I said. The groundhog that didn't know he was a man nodded, then turned to his hole and swan dove into it. When he emerged again, he was wearing a giant groundhog suit that looked more like a stuffed animal groundhog than a real one. Now he began to poodle prance around his hole in a jaded elliptical shape. People cheered. Some people removed sandwiches from picnic baskets and stuffed them into their delirious grins. The end. The next one is called Yak on a Hot Tin Roof. A group of firemen suddenly grew bored with the sound of the siren on their fire engine. They decided to replace the siren with a small yak, which they kidnapped from a shelter that houses hobos and animals that are not indigenous to metropolitan domains. The firemen removed the siren and superglued the yak's hooves to the roof of the fire engine. They stared at each other and waited for a fire to start somewhere in the city. No fire started. Annoyed, the firemen disguised themselves as arsonists, snuck a few blocks down the street, and set a building on fire. Then they ran back to the fire station, took off their disguises, put on their big red hats and uniforms, and piled into the fire engine. "Scream!" the fireman behind the steering wheel said to the yak as the garage door creaked open and they pulled onto the street. His head was sticking out of the window, and he was looking up and glaring hatefully at the yak. "I said, scream, you!" The yak didn't respond. It didn't even look down at the driver and blink. The driver told the fireman in the passenger seat to get up there on the roof and make that yak scream. Fireman hesitated at first, but then he climbed up on the roof, adopted the stance and voice of a drill sergeant, and screamed in the yak's ear. "Scream, you son of a bitch! Scream, you sick bastard!" he screamed. The yak made a noise that sounded like a baby burping. "We need a new yak," the fireman blurted. The yak nudged him in the belly with its shoulder and sent him flying off the fire engine and through the front window of a haberdasher's shop. Bowlers and fedoras spilled onto the sidewalk and street in an hysterical mudslide. Irate, the driver told a fireman in the backseat to go make the yak scream. The fireman said he was scared of heights. The driver swore at him and told him that acrophobic firemen are oxymoronic and can't possibly exist. Reluctantly, the fireman agreed. He clambered onto the roof and tried his best to scare the yak into screaming submission, but the yak nudged him off of the fire engine and he flew through the front window of a haberdasher shop too. This time it was tandos and 10-gallon hats that flooded the sidewalk and street. Having a special penchant for 10-gallon hats, the driver peered at his rearview mirror in envy of the pedestrians that fell on the hats like sharks on bleeding carcasses. The same thing kept happening after that. One by one, the firemen were ordered to climb up on the roof, and so they did it and screamed at the yak and were nudged off of the fire engine into a haberdasher's shop until the only fireman left was the driver, who promptly abandoned the wheel, crawled out of his window and onto the roof. He crossed his arms over his chest and frowned at the yak. The fire engine was out of control. Cars, people, and pets were leaping out of its way as it soundlessly, recklessly swerved down the street. The fireman grabbed the yak by the neck and nearly stuck his whole face into its ear. "What's your problem?" he hollered. "We're almost to the fire and you haven't made a peep yet. You're embarrassing me. How are people supposed to know we're coming?" The yak shrugged before throwing its shoulder into the fireman's ribcage. "Sound off," said the fireman in a last gasp effort to activate the yak as he sailed through the air towards that window full of hats. The effort, of course, was in vain. The fire engine rambled past the burning building, and it was not until much later, when the vehicle had left the city in its dust, that the yak broke its silence. Cruising across fields of deep, empty green, the animal opened its mouth and discharged a noise loud enough to shatter reality. The end. Okay. Tough crowd, tough crowd. Let's try a story called Professor Dyspeptical's Parrot. Don't treat these stories seriously. There's not an ounce of seriousness to them. Professor Dyspeptical decided he would rather not teach his classes anymore. The lectures he had to write and present every day required an unreasonable amount of time and effort to prepare, not to mention that his students all despised him. He would much rather stay in bed all day, watching talk shows and soap operas while sipping mimosas from the glittery high-heeled shoe of a drag queen. Then, in the evenings, he could dress up like a drag queen and carelessly prance up and down the sidewalks of his neighborhood instead of correcting papers and trying to figure out which of his students despised him with the most enthusiasm. Determined to give up, the professor visited a pet store and bought a parrot. He took the bird home, fed it a piece of dry pound cake, and taught it how to talk and act like an intelligent human being. The next day at 12:38 p.m., 2 minutes before his first class began, the professor was laying in bed, half drunk, fully naked, a dipstick smile painted onto his rubicund face. On the television was an advertisement for a new brand of cereal that filled him with glee. The door of the classroom creaked open at 12:39 p.m. There was a pause. During the pause, the students glanced and blinked at one another. The students glanced and blinked at one another with more vigor when the parrot fluttered into the classroom. The handle of a small leather briefcase clenched in its sharp black beak. It was wearing miniature pince-nez, and much of its colorful body was concealed by a little tailor-made tweed jacket. The parrot landed on the podium. It removed a few tiny, crinkled papers from the briefcase with a mindful claw. It cracked its neck, stretched out its wings, cleared its throat. "Good afternoon, class," said the parrot. "Professor Dyspeptical has come down with a syndrome and will be out of commission for an indefinite length of time. Hence, I will be teaching this class in his stead. Do not be offset by the fact that I do not hold a PhD in the subject. The underlying content and structure of the lectures I will be presenting were conceived of by the aforementioned professor. True, I edit his lectures with extreme prejudice, but I nonetheless ask you to think of me as nothing more than a medium. Today, I will be deliberating Freud's Notes Upon a Case of Obsessional Neurosis, otherwise known as the Rat Man case history. I am particularly interested in Freud's notion that the rat man is a victim of a persistent, if not rabid, anal eroticisms, and the impact that this notion has on Freud's general psychoanalytic angle of incidence. I will begin by reading a passage from the case history that can be found on page 52 in your texts. Professor Dyspeptical's parrot continued to preside over his classes for 2 weeks before his students retaliated. Began when a young frat boy visited a pet store and bought a parrot. He took the bird back to his fraternity house, fed it a pint of Mad Dog and a six-pack of Natural Light, and taught it how to simulate interest in uninteresting things. For good measure, he also taught it how to talk dirty to sorority girls. Then he gave it his books, pointed in the direction of the building in which Professor Dyspeptical's classroom was located, and went to a bar to get drunk and late. The parrot that had taken over for Professor Dyspeptical evil-eyed the parrot that had taken over for the frat boy when it flapped into the classroom and drunkenly zigzagged over to the frat boy's seat. It's one thing for a professor to replace himself with a bird, the professor's parrot told itself, but it's quite another thing for a student to do the same thing. That's horseshit. Still, the professor's parrot didn't say anything. It merely continued to evil-eye the frat boy's parrot for a few more seconds before turning to the day's lecture. A student's intelligence is only put to use when the possibility of avoiding the accumulation of knowledge, and consequently the amplification of intelligence, exposes itself. It wasn't long before all of Professor Dyspeptical's classes were populated by parrots. Like the students they represented, most of the parrots were drunk on cheap wine and beer and wore tattered pieces of clothing, and all of them were experts at simulating interest in information that authority figures communicated to them. One night, Professor Dyspeptical's parrot tried to tell Professor Dyspeptical that his students had followed his lead and were using talking animals to signify themselves. The parrot had been hesitant to bring it up before, knowing that the professor didn't want to be bothered with the social dynamics of his classes. But the whole fiasco was really starting to get on its nerves. The professor didn't care. In fact, he took a certain sadistic pleasure in his parrot's consternation. Lounging on his bed in blood-red Victoria's Secret lingerie, he said, "It's a terrible thing to be despised, isn't it?" "I don't feel despised," replied the parrot. "It has nothing to do with how I think your students' parrots perceive me. I just feel perturbed. I just feel weird." "I'm sorry to hear that," said the professor. "Would you be a doll and go make me a martini, please? Thank you, sir." After that, Professor Dyspeptical's parrot never mentioned the issue again. There was no point in mentioning it. Word spread and sued all kinds of people, not just one insignificant professor and a bunch of his students, were retreating into the shadows and representing themselves with parrots. Businessmen, newscasters, computer technicians, janitors, lawyers, fry cooks, politicians, priests, even movie stars and television personalities had all turned to the bird, as the saying went, so that they could pursue their true interests, usually something sexual, and be who they really wanted to be, usually some kind of pervert. Eventually, everybody turned to the bird. What had come to be known as the dyspeptical gesture swept across the world like a new and improved sexually transmitted disease. Even homeless people and denizens of third world countries managed to scrounge up enough spare change to purchase surrogate parrots from pet stores. On the streets of every city, in the fields of every countryside, on the televisions of every home, not a person was to be seen or heard. The goings-on of everyday life had been entirely given up to a parrot existence. It wasn't long before Professor Dyspeptical's parrot decided it would rather not teach its classes anymore. The lectures it had to present every day required an unreasonable amount of time and effort to enunciate, not to mention that it was sick of dressing up all the time in miniature human clothes. It also came to believe that its stand-in students did, in fact, despise it. Determined to give up, the parrot visited a pet store, bought a parrot, took the parrot home, fed it a claw full of bird seed, and taught it how to talk like an intelligent parrot that has been taught how to talk like an intelligent human being. The next day at 12:38 p.m., Professor Dyspeptical's parrot was laying on Professor Dyspeptical's big pink belly, half drunk, fully naked, a dipstick smile carved into its crooked beak. On the television was an advertisement for a new brand of peanut butter that filled it with glee. The end. All right, we're doing better now. Let's see. The next one I'll read is called Disney Reanimated. And I don't know if this is true. I mean, I got this idea from the notion that Disney is presumably buried in a cryogenic crypt beneath the Pirates of the Caribbean ride in Disney World, waiting for the technology to be developed so that he can be reincarnated and brought back to life. Yeah, that's totally true. And there's a little maxim that prefaces this story. It's by Jean Baudrillard. It reads, "God is not dead, he has become hyper-real." Disney reanimated. Eventually, badass worked. Named after the self-proclaimed disposition of the biochemist who created it, the drug was administered by means of a simple single injection. More baboons were killed than soldiers in the Civil War before badass was perfected. Then one day a dead monkey opened its eyes, cursed in its native language as if walking into the embittered bear hug of a hangover, rolled onto its feet, squatted, and defecated all over the clean white floor of the laboratory. Scientists present broke out into song and lit long, expensive cigars. Between songs and cigar puffs, they talked about what, or rather who, to do next. Clearly, the baboon was functioning normally. And if it continued to function normally for a sufficient duration and passed all of the requisite tests, it was only logical that badass be tried out on a human subject. But who? That night at the bar, the scientists came to a quick, unanimous decision. In the not-too-distant future, they packed their bags, divorced their wives, moral support no longer needed from those Susie Homemakers, and flew to Disneyland. They spent a few days entertaining themselves on the park's rides and dining on sauerkraut and sausage links in the restaurants of a simulacrum of Germany. Then they got bored and decided it was time to exhume Walt Disney's body. The body was located underneath the Pirates of the Caribbean attraction in a cryogenic crypt. Prior to his death by cancer, Disney had requested that his dead body be preserved in deep freeze until the technology to reanimate him was developed. So the scientists ferried him to a simulacrum of a German hospital, thawed him out, and gave him a shot of badass. Disney cursed in the voice of Mickey Mouse after he opened his eyes. As he rolled onto his feet, squatted, and defecated on the clean white floor of the operating room, the scientists once again resorted to singing and smoking, and subsequently a group of slapdash orderlies wearing synthetic moose antlers rolled a few trash cans full of grain alcohol into the room, and everybody started to get drunk. "Can I have some toilet paper?" Disney asked. This time he employed the ornery voice of Donald Duck, which I can't do. "I could use a pair of pants and a shirt, too." Nobody paid attention to him, too busy partying and talking on their cell phones, making dinner plans with full-figured five large-a-night hookers. Disney sighed. He drank a few handfuls of grain alcohol, stole a dirty surgeon's outfit from a locker in the closet, and snuck away. In addition to the hypodermic full of badass, Disney had been injected with a little geriatric cocktail that made him look a little younger and a little more handsome than when he had died at the age of 65. Not that it mattered to him. He had never cared much about his own image unless he was making a television appearance. But he looked pretty good right now, despite his outfit, which was crinkled up and stained in places with blood. Out in the streets of Disneyland, people recognized him as a Walt Disney lookalike dressed in a mad scientist costume. "I'm not a lookalike," he kept telling the children that came up to him and kicked him in the kneecaps for playing what they considered to be a bad joke on him. "I'm the real thing. They just reanimated me a few minutes ago. Seriously." Nobody took him seriously. Finally, an indignant group of parents, thinking he was a liar, told him he ought to be ashamed of himself for filling their children's heads with nonsense. He wanted to tell them that he had spent his lifetime filling children's heads with nonsense. Nobody had ever complained until now. But he refrained, suddenly realizing that the children and parents were not children and parents. They were lookalikes of children and parents. The park was filled with children and parent lookalikes. It occurred to him when a young, innocent boy unzipped his chest and face, and a midget in a pinstripe suit shrugged us out of his skin. A number of other people, he noticed, did likewise for no apparent reason. A security guard unzipped himself, and out came a groundskeeper. An ugly pigeon-toed woman with no boobs and no sense of style unzipped herself, and out came a busty porn star in a lavish ballroom gown. A wiry, blonde-haired Aryan in a scuba-diving outfit emerged from the fleshy shell of a fat black woman with an afro. Another well-dressed midget relinquished itself from the guise of a child. There was one person, a mustachioed gentleman, wearing an origami uniform that looked the exact same on the inside as he did on the outside. That is, the face, body, and outfit that constituted his outer layer was a replica of the face, body, and outfit that constituted his inner layer. Everywhere Disney looked, people were randomly shedding their bodies like snakes. He wasn't the fraud here, they were. What right did they have to assume he was an imposter? No matter what he said, he knew he would not be able to convince them otherwise. In a sense, they were right. If the world is constituted mainly by representations of the real, who's to say that the representations aren't themselves the real? Majority rules, after all. Depressed, Walt Disney decided to leave Disneyland. He didn't know where he would go. For now, getting out was enough. The only problem was, every exit door he encountered was only a look-alike exit door. And when he tried to open them, it only looked like he was trying to open them. "Shit," said Disney. "I can't get out of here." As he spoke the words, a giant Goofy approached him. "Nice outfit," it said. Disney's mustache twitched in distress. "It's not an outfit." "Think so?" replied the Goofy and unzipped itself. Beneath was Pluto. Pluto unzipped itself and revealed a real dog, a St. Bernard with a tiny barrel of booze hanging from its neck. The St. Bernard proceeded to unzip itself as well. Have you ever tried to take yourself off? Asked a girl that resembled a broken-down version of Judy Garland as Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. Her voice was the deep-seated rasp of an actor who had drank and smoked his way through life. Maybe if you tried to step out of yourself, you'd think differently. Disney spit on Dorothy's glittery shoes.
Beat it, geek, he snarled.
The Dorothy made a face, shrugged, turned and skipped away, leaving pixie dust in her wake and leaving Disney in a state of high anxiety. Maybe she's right, he thought. Maybe I'm not who I think I am. Jesus, is there a zipper on my body? He was afraid to feel himself up, but he did it anyway. Sure enough, there was a zipper. A tiny, almost imperceptible plastic tab was sticking out of the nape of his clavicle bone. He screamed. He dashed back to the simulacrum hospital to interrogate the scientists that had reanimated him. Clearly, those bastards were responsible for all this. Back in his day, people didn't make a habit out of taking their bodies off, and he certainly didn't used to have a zipper on his own body, which presumably could be taken off too. Somebody had some goddamn explaining to do. When Disney returned to the operating room in which the injection of badass had been administered, he found the room teeming with baboons. The skins of the scientists littered the floor, and the baboons, all of them pissed drunk, were gibbering and farting and belching and drooling oceans of saliva and making all kinds of obscene gestures. A few of them were having sex with long-legged prostitutes. Disney blinked at the spectacle. He was irked, but he wasn't freaked out. Part of him had almost expected it. Excuse me. I'm back, he said. No response. Hey, you people. Hey, you sons of bitches. No response. Annoyed, Disney dealt the monkeys a long, lewd invective. Not surprisingly, he was ignored. He blustered into a storeroom circumscribed by shelves packed with medical supplies. Standing there alone in the darkness, he meditatively tapped his foot against the floor and filled and refilled his cheeks with air. He hit the light switch. He flexed his jaw and pinched the tab of his zipper. Inside Walt Disney was another Walt Disney. He was an exact replica of the recently shed Walt Disney and was also equipped with a zipper. Walt Disney unzipped and squirmed out of himself and exposed another Walt Disney. Inside this Walt Disney was another Walt Disney. Inside that Walt Disney was another Walt Disney. Inside that Walt Disney was yet another Walt Disney. Inside that Walt Disney was still another Walt Disney. He wanted to stop taking himself off, but he was obsessed now. There was no going back. He would keep taking himself off until he could no longer take himself off, until he found out what lay at the core of his body, his being, his identity. Every time Disney disposed of another layer of himself, the replica that emerged was a little bit smaller. Eventually, he was so small, even a microscope would have had to squirm to see him clearly. At this point of diminution, he removed his last layer. There was a flickering neon sign. Rectangular in shape, the sign was no bigger than an electron. Written on it in a humdrum font was an anagram for the real name of God. Aha! Disney yawped. But he didn't yawp anything. He had no mouth with which to speak, and by degrees, the sign stopped flickering and faded out to black. The end. How are we doing for time? Wow. All right, this is going to be an experiment. I like to practice my stories beforehand, before I read them. I haven't practiced this one, but it's a little bit longer. It's one of the longer pieces in here. Might be good for a chits and giggles. It's called The Ostensibly Immortal Piece of Bread. And this will be the last one, I guess. So this is, that last one was a kind of, I don't always write science fiction. I mean, and the science fiction that I do write is very soft and it's not very technologically oriented. This is obvious. This one, I guess you could, has elements of science fiction to it, mainly because of the one apparatus that this guy uses in it, which you'll see. The Ostensibly Immortal Piece of Bread. There is a piece of bread sitting on a shelf in my pantry. It's been sitting there for over 4 weeks now. 4 weeks. I've been waiting patiently for it to grow mold. It won't grow any mold on it. Usually when I buy a piece of bread, I only have to wait a few days before it starts to go bad. The longest it's ever taken a piece of bread of mine to go bad is 9 days. I've had this piece of bread for 33 days. It's still as fresh smelling and as fresh looking as it was when I purchased it from the baker. I even threw the bread in the darkest, dankest, dingiest corner of the darkest, dankest, dingiest closet in my flat and left it there for a week. When I retrieved it, the thing still looked good as new. I was distraught, bereft, antagonized. I think I might have cried. The days continued to pass, and I became more and more estranged as the piece of bread insisted on remaining pristine, unsullied, and good enough to eat. And so I have decided to return to the baker who sold me this piece of bread and kill him. In addition to being a violent or turbulent situation and a whirlpool of extraordinary size, a maelstrom is also an apparatus that, when it's not in use, resembles a dirty knee sock. It even smells like a dirty knee sock. Once you slip your arm into it, though, and the smell disappears, and the exterior of the maelstrom mirrors over as the delicate hairs that line its interior, like a mink pelt, slip themselves into your pores and metabolize with your nervous system. This is a little excruciating. A few seconds later, the mercurial skin of the maelstrom fades and pales until the color of its skin is indistinguishable from your own. It's good camouflage, only now it looks like a shaved one of your arms. But who pays attention to arm hair these days? The maelstrom is a highly effective and entertaining weapon, particularly for ultraviolence enthusiasts. Imagine your fist and forearm is a stick of boiling hot lava wrapped in razor wire. Then imagine the lava and the razor wire are physical manifestations of post-structuralist theory. After I slipped the maelstrom on and waited for it to coalesce with me, I made sure it was functional by testing it out on an old stainless steel cappuccino maker that I never use. Simply held out my forearm and placed the machine on top of it. 6 seconds later, the machine had been deconstructed and assimilated. The bakery was only a few blocks from my building. On the way there, I bumped into an old friend of mine. His name was Ed Kraps, and he didn't recognize me. This was understandable. Not only had we not seen each other for years, I was disguised as a bag lady. But then Eddie snapped his fingers and said, "It's you!" He thrust his hand out for a shake. He was left-handed, and so was I. On instinct, I grabbed his hand and began to pump it. The inside of his hand became the outside, and the outside melted into the maelstrom and was gone. "Oops," I said. Ed lifted his arm to his face and stared incredulously at the grisly wrist, which looked like somebody had stuck a clump of burnt, bloody mincemeat onto the end of it. He began to convulse and foam at the mouth. White froth spilled all over his tie and business suit. Finally, he collapsed onto the sidewalk. It all happened in a matter of seconds. Not knowing what to do, I apologized. With my free, maelstromless hand, I captured a passing stray dog, shook the dog until it passed out, and placed it on top of him to conceal him. The dog wasn't much bigger than a human head, but it would have to do. I pushed the front door of the bakery open and stepped inside. Immediately, I was accosted by the baker's major domo. His name was Mr. Dangletooth. He was a short man with a short man's complex who used to be the mayor of the city until his wife left him for a haberdasher. After his nervous breakdown, he was forced out of politics and into the baking industry, the only industry that tolerates, and in some cases caters to, unstable psyches. Mr. Dangletooth was wearing a pinstripe suit that was two sizes too big for him. The she-she dress shirt he had on was fairly tremendous, too. His beady-eyed pinhead was barely peeking out of its collar. He resembled a one-time tall, fat man who had shrunk in his clothes. I didn't like him. "What do you want? What do you want?" he bleated. Mr. Dangletooth didn't like me either. Partly because I was tall, partly because I made no effort to conceal the fact that I didn't like him. "Do you have business here today?" I didn't reply to him, didn't even acknowledge his self-conscious existence. I looked over his head and scanned the bakery for the baker. Crowded in here today, and loud. Sounded like the floor of the stock exchange during prime time, only the cool buzz of voices and catcalls didn't rise and fall, it remained constant. As usual, the customers all looked like bag ladies, although there were only a handful of actual bag ladies in the place. Baker's peculiar neuroses would only allow him to sell bread to that strain of people. Since everybody wanted and needed bread, and since the baker's bakery was the only reputable, reasonably priced bakery in the city, everybody who wasn't a bag lady, if they wanted a portion of decent bread, had to disguise themselves in that fashion in order to purchase it. This policy was staunchly upheld, yet inattentive to authenticity. In most cases, it was easy to tell who was and who was not a bag lady. As long as the baker's customers made an effort to cater to his absurd demand, though, he would grant them the pleasure of their sourdough, their focaccia, their honey whole wheat, and so on. The bag lady disguise I had on was decent, but it was nothing special. A broomhead hat, loud rundown high heels, a moth-eaten skirt and shawl, torn fishnet stockings, some hastily applied rouge, some false buck teeth, a fake wart on my nose, crappy bag slung over my shoulder, standard ensemble. Had I wanted to impress the baker and make his day, I would have jumped into a garbage bin and rolled around for an hour or two, maybe even slept there for a night. But I didn't want to stand out and draw attention to myself. The baker was nowhere in sight. All I saw above and across the ragamuffin heads of the customers were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 order takers behind the counter, trying to negotiate the orders that were being spit at them from the fistfuls of cash that were being waved and thrust in their faces. Where was the baker? Usually he was standing on an elevated podium, artfully situated in the far corner of the bakery. With eyes wide and alert, with chin held high, with arms folded across his hogshead chest, the baker, who only baked at night when the bakery was closed so that he could maintain this panoptic position during the day, kept one vigilant, intimidating eye on his staff and the other on his customers, ensuring that nobody in his jurisdiction stepped out of line in any way. Nobody ever stepped out of line. He was a powerful man, the baker. Stood almost 7 feet in the air and had the bulging, ripped-up physique of a bodybuilder. Everybody was afraid of him. Not so afraid that people didn't push and shove and carp and curse one another under their breath, but nobody pushed and shoved too hard, or carped and cursed one another under their breath too loudly, even in the baker's presence. The absence of the baker, which is a rare occurrence during business hours, is almost as declarative as his presence, and that his absence ordains that his presence may be reinstated without warning at any given time. Personally, I had never been here in the baker's absence, but I had heard about it. It felt strange. I looked down at Mr. Dangletooth. I blinked and cocked my head as if I had just noticed him. His shrill, wet eyes and the crooked sequence of lines on his forehead told me he was well aware that I'd been well aware of his company from the moment I stepped into the door. I was trying to get his goat, and he knew it. What he didn't know was that my primary motive for coming here was to kill the baker. Having the opportunity to irritate the baker's major domo in the process was just a convenient diversion. I continued to irritate Mr. Dangletooth by playing dumb. In a half-assed bag lady voice, I said, "Oh, hello. Do you know where I might find the baker?" Mr. Dangletooth wound up and fastballed a dirty look at my face. I could almost feel its impact. I expected him to start hollering at me. He didn't. Maintaining his dirty look, he reached inside of his outfit, fished around for a second, and pulled out a long, crumpled sheet of paper with patches of chicken scratch all over it. He gave it a cursory glance and said to me, "I'm sorry. You're not on the list, sir. You'll have to leave. Please leave now." The restraint with which my maelstrom-cloaked arm was kept from lashing out and hammering Mr. Dangletooth in the face was immense, that restraint. It would have given me so much pleasure to nail that little stuck-up peon and put an end to his uppity sass once and for all. But I had to keep things in perspective. I was here for the baker, not the baker's major domo. Put up with the man, I told myself. Don't make a scene. I leaned closer to Mr. Dangletooth. "You're telling me everybody in this bakery is on that piece of paper? Let me see it." I reached out and tried to take it from him. He mashed it up and stuffed it back inside of his suit. "I'm not telling you anything," he replied, "other than to get out. Will you or will not you not get out of here?" "On what grounds? What is this, a country club? Look at me." I dipped to one side and then the other, showing off my bag ladiness. "I'm doing my part. Knock this crap off and let me by." "Pardon me," croaked two bag ladies. One was walking in the door, the other was walking out with three slices of what looked like plum bread in hand. Full loaves weren't for sale in the bakery, incidentally. Bread was only sold by the slice, and there was a 3-slice limit per customer, but you could come back as many times a day as you'd like. Both bag ladies bumped into me as they passed. I snarled at them. Then I snarled at Mr. Dangletooth. He was standing in front of me, barring my way like a fire hydrant. I got rid of my bag lady voice and said, "Well, I don't see you giving that one," pointing at the bag lady that had just entered, an imposter like me whose outfit was far less convincing than mine. "I don't see you giving that one a hard time. I don't even know why I'm wasting my breath talking to you. Back off. Back off or else." "Or else what?" Mr. Dangletooth huffed. I bent over, placed my chin in front of his nose, and drilled a high heel into the floor. "Or else you'll make me hate me," I seethed. A tent of fear pitched itself on his face. Good. Now we were getting somewhere. "Move aside, you," I ordered. Mr. Dangletooth held his ground for a second or two before complying. As I made my way past him, however, he grabbed me by the elbow. I froze, rigid with fury, and peered down at him with round, rabbit eyes. In his hand was the crumpled up slip of paper again. "If I could just get you to sign your name on this document here," he said in a pleasant but assertive voice, as if we had not just had an altercation. "And then if you could do me the favor of undergoing a retinal scan, well, there's a very good possibility you might be able to carry on with your business. Very good possibility indeed." Suddenly the maelstrom seemed to develop a personality of its own. I felt it tense, shudder, and cock itself, and I had to grab it on the wrist with my free hand to keep it from flinging out. It had no effect on my hand. The maelstrom roots were snug in my flesh and synapsed to my nerves. It knew who was and who wasn't part of the family. I closed my eyes and took a deep breath. Mr. Dangletooth had ceased to be a convenient diversion. He had quickly evolved into a raging menace. I open my eyes and survey the bakery again. Still no baker. Still a horde of customers trying and failing to be served in a timely fashion by overworked, more or less incompetent order takers. Three more bag ladies entered the bakery and whisked by me. I flexed my jaw. I shook my head. I turned and faced Mr. Dangletooth. He shoved the paper and a ballpoint pen towards me. Ignoring the gesture, I unzipped my bag and removed the piece of bread that wouldn't grow mold on it. I presented the bread to Mr. Dangletooth in an open palm. "Do you see this piece of bread?" I asked. "Yes, yes, I see it," he replied. "It's over a month old." "Uh-huh," he said. "Uh-huh, that's all you have to say?" Mr. Dangletooth's arms flopped to his side. "What do you want me to say?" "I don't know," I griped. "How about swearing in disbelief?" "Holy shit," he monotoned. I stuck a mad finger in his face. "You little creep, why don't you and I just cut out the bullshit and talk straight, okay?" "I prefer not to," he retaliated with an air of superiority. "Without bullshit, I really wouldn't have a great deal to say." "I prefer to have something to say." "Shut up," I said. Mr. Dangletooth blinked. I blinked back. "Listen to me. This bread in my hand, this piece of bread I'm holding underneath your crummy nose, any idea where I bought it? Don't bother answering because I'm going to tell you where I bought it in the next sentence that comes out of my mouth. I bought it here, right here, in this bakery. And you know what else? This piece of bread is 33 days old and there's not even a speck of mold on it. Are you beginning to understand? Are you beginning to catch my drift? I certainly hope so. Now then, I demand to see the baker at once." Majordomo frowned at the bread. He sniffed its underside, touched its outer ridge with a pinky finger. At last, he pensively ran his tongue back and forth across his teeth. "Doesn't look like a 33-day-old piece of bread to me," he shrugged. "For all I know, you could have bought it yesterday. You have a receipt?" "You know the baker doesn't believe in receipts," Mr. Dangletooth smirked. "So he doesn't. Well, I don't know what to tell you. There's simply no way that piece of bread is 33 days old. If it was, it wouldn't look so youthful and rosy. I don't understand what you're trying to do. Do you hope to get a free slice of bread out of this? Is that it? You have a slice of bread, sir. A perfectly healthy, perfectly good-looking slice of bread. Go home and enjoy it." I returned the bread to my bag. Not caring if I made a scene anymore, I used my free hand to grab Mr. Dangletooth by his too long, atrociously patterned tie. I yanked his hobbit-like face up to within an inch or two of my own. "Hey! I put a lot of effort into watching that thing not grow mold on it over the last few weeks. Who are you to say that I haven't?" Seemingly unaffected by my powerful grip, which I intensified, and which then clearly affected him, Mr. Dangletooth squelched, "Why do you care if mold grows on your bread or not? Most people would rejoice in a piece of bread that refuses to be devastated by time." The hint of halitosis I tasted on his breath crippled my fury. I was ready to strangle him, or even better, to hold him out in front of me like a rag doll and slap him back and forth across the cheeks with my maelstrom, which would rip off and assimilate his cheeks and most of the facial features attached to them, as if they were made of cotton candy instead of flesh. But once my nose got a whiff of his hideous breath, I found myself as tame as a sedated ape in a cage. I let go of the man's tie and took a step back, giving him some room to reorganize himself. As he picked up the paper and pen he had dropped and adjusted his tie and collar, I said, "That's not the point, whether or not I or anybody else might rejoice in this ostensibly immortal piece of bread. The point is, this piece of bread is ostensibly immortal. Now get out of my way." At my exclamation, the loudest and most resonant exclamation to leap out of my mouth since my arrival, every single bag lady in the bakery stopped grunting and throwing elbows at one another and looked over their shoulders at me. Even the order takers paused. Everything was absolutely still, absolutely silent. At least 54 boating eyes were staring at me. Did I care? No, I didn't. Under different circumstances, I might have cared. I don't like it when one person stares at me, let alone a whole go herd. But not today. I stared back at them with eyes that said, "I could care less if you're staring at me. Stare at me all day and night if you like. It won't matter. No, it won't matter to me." The population of the bakery read this message in my gaze and all at once returned to their affairs. The baker's persistent absence was beginning to make me paranoid. First, I was just irked by it. Now I began to think that the baker's absence was a result of my presence. I wondered if he was watching me through the video cameras in the ceiling corners. I wondered if he was peering up at me through a knothole in the bakery's weathered hardwood floor. I wondered if he was watching me through the disguise of a bag lady. Finally, I forgot about the baker and wondered if everything that happens in the world is in reference to me. Mr. Dangletooth drew me out of my reverie. He reached up and snapped his fingers in front of each of my ear holes and then in front of my face, just a millimeter or two beyond the tip of my nose. My eyes fluttered. And I calmly told the major domo to go to hell. You go to hell, he replied. I'm in hell, but that's as obvious as a kidney punch, isn't it? Just don't snap your fingers at me is all I'm saying. I hope you're listening to me. He wasn't listening to me. He wasn't even looking at me. His brow a rumpled mass of flesh. He was scratching his chin and staring at my arm, the one with the maelstrom on it. The shawl on my back was a ratty piece of crud and only concealed the upper portion of my body. My bare arms, one hairy, one seemingly not hairy, had been exposed to the major domo's eyes all along. Why had he chosen this moment to recognize the incongruity? Why had he noticed the incongruity at all? Most people don't take note of these kinds of things. Then again, Mr. Dangletooth wasn't most people. Why have you shaven one of your arms, he smirked. You shave one arm, but you don't shave the other one? Ha! That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life. Or were you born with a hairless arm? Whatever the case, you're a nincompoop. Why don't you just go away and never come back again? Before I had a chance to respond, he turned around and announced to the entire room, this stupid nincompoop has shaved one of his arms and left the other one hairy. Can you believe it? I mean, can you people believe it? They couldn't. Everybody paused and looked at me again with twice the intensity that they had looked at me just a moment ago. Some of them began to point at my arm, shake their heads, and whisper belittling marks in each other's ears. I caught a few people grabbing hold of their mouths to keep them from exploding into hysterics. Mr. Dangletooth didn't bother grabbing his mouth. He threw back his puny, bald head, and his mouth opened and yacked out a choppy stream of laughter. Well, that was the last draw. Of course, it was the last draw. I backhanded Mr. Dangletooth across his laughing face with a maelstrom. His face came off and left behind what looked like the aftermath of a bite-sized grenade nailing him between the eyes. His skull was clearly visible. My quick but dire blow had dismembered his jawbone, which hung there like a lynched thing. It had also ripped out an eyeball. I watched the eyeball, along with the rest of his facial flesh, disappear into my bubbling, fizzing, gruesome forearm. 5 short seconds later, though, my forearm smoothed over. Except for the hairlessness, it looked like a normal forearm again. Everybody gaped and gasped as the living remains of Mr. Dangletooth, who didn't know what hit him, and who would never know what hit him, dropped to the floor like a pillar of bowling balls that abruptly and collectively decide they would prefer not to be stacked upon one another anymore. He gurgled. He gesticulated. He lost control of his bodily functions. He curled up into a ball like a potato bug and lay still. I turned to my audience and shrugged my shoulders once, powerfully. My shawl flew off my back. I was naked from the waist up now, my lower half concealed only by my skirt, stockings, and heels. My muscular, hairy chest was in full view, and I flexed my pectorals one at a time. Then I tipped my head and shook off my hat, unleashing enviable flaxen locks, and I spit out my buck teeth onto the floor. Gross, said a bag lady impersonator's 6-year-old child. Like her mother, she was accordingly decorated. I pointed at the child with a finger that said, keep your disgust to yourself, young fiend. I'm going to give you something to be truly disgusted about. The frightened child's mouth became a hole. I nodded. The child dove underneath her mother's cruddy burlap skirt, never to be seen again. My bag slipped from my shoulder when I shrugged off my shawl. I'd been careful not to touch the bag or any other garnish or article of clothing I had on with the maelstrom, which would suck anything it touched that wasn't my own flesh and bone into oblivion. I had not been so careful with Eddie Crabb's hand. In any case, there was adrenaline squirting through my tubes now. Naturally, I was a little on edge, and I almost picked up the bag with the maelstrom. That would have been the end of my campaign here. Had I picked it up with the maelstrom, the bag and the piece of bread inside of it would have been history. That bread was proof that the baker wasn't holding up his end of the bargain. What was his end of the bargain? To produce and peddle bread that submits to the laws of human physics. But I caught and tamed my maelstrom before it had a chance to do any dirty work, so in that respect, all was well. I retrieved the piece of bread from the bag. I spread my legs apart, gently gripped the bread by its crust with the fingertips and thumb tip of my free hand, and brandished the bread over my head for all eyes to see. This piece of bread you see in my hand is ostensibly immortal, I said in a commanding, echoing voice. I purchased it from this bakery 33 days ago, and it has yet to grow mold on it. In effect, I have returned to this bakery to kill the baker. Killing the baker's major domo was not my intent, but the man was antagonizing me. Don't get the wrong impression. I feel no remorse for killing him. I didn't like him. Why would I want something that I don't like to continue to exist? Still, his death was not premeditated. Not in a formal sense, anyway. I fantasized about his death on a number of occasions. True. But I never anticipated the realization of my fantasies. Do you understand? It doesn't matter if you do or you don't. Just show me the baker. Show him to me at once. I don't know where he is, but I have a feeling somebody in this room does. I kindly ask you to produce him for me. Mark my use of the word kindly, people. If my desires are not fulfilled right now, right away, I may have to exercise the words polar opposite. Frozen, unable to speak, awestruck, obviously totally helpless, my audience could do nothing but glare at me with trembling chins. I heard the door jangle open behind me and sniffed the stench of rotten banana peels and Vienna sausages. Go away, I snapped without turning around. There was a gasp as the potential bread buyer no doubt caught sight of Mr. Dangletooth's corpse and the corpse's steaming head. The door jangled closed. I'm asking you sons of bitches a question, and I want an answer, I said. I was on the brink of losing the shred of temper that remained in me. Where is the baker? My paralyzed audience didn't budge. I flexed my jaw, took a step forward. One of the bag ladies took a step forward. At last, a bag lady with a pair of balls. I could distinguish neither the gender nor the authenticity of this aggressor. But whether the person had actual balls and was actually a homeless weirdo didn't mean a thing to me. What meant something to me was this fortitude, this willingness to step into the ring and face me like a real man in drag. She lifted, it's like the sh slash he, meant to be read, not read aloud. We'll do it this way. He lifted a hand and stabbed a crooked bony finger at me. I waited for the person to say something. He didn't. He just kept stabbing. I spat, the baker, where is he? Silence. Silence. And then he opened her mouth. The present whereabouts of the baker don't matter, so you can just forget about it, he said in a calm, creaky, genderless voice. The matter at hand here is your inability, or rather your disability, to come to terms with that ostensibly immortal piece of bread. This is not the baker's fault, nor is it my fault or any of my brothers and sisters in arms' fault. That is your fault. The shocking thing about it is that you lack the sense to draw this conclusion on your own. Or maybe you do have the sense to draw that conclusion and chose not to use it. Or maybe you actually drew the conclusion and chose to ignore it. I don't care what your impetus was. I only care that you acknowledge your idiocy to yourself and go about your business. That said, he lowered her finger, turned around and made her way, to the counter. The rest of the bag ladies, after a short pause during which they nodded at me disparagingly, followed in her wake. The bustle of consumerism revived in carry-on as if it had never been interrupted. Nice invective, I said, mostly to myself. First class, really. I'm not just saying that. I was ignored. It would have cost me a certain amount of sweat, but I was confident that I could accomplish a massacre without too much trouble. I stood there and considered doing it for a long time, my eyes fixed on the smooth ersatz flesh of the maelstrom. I imagined myself at the center of a tremendous coliseum swarming with lunatic bag ladies that I gruesomely deconstructed one after the other, the deafening cheer roar of the faceless spectators in the grandstands making me stronger, happier, full of so much joy. I was intensely saddened at the prospect of losing so much joy, so I killed faster and with more flair until nothing remained on the main floor of the coliseum except for a few monstrous, trashy piles of body parts and me, the grinning, bare-chested gladiator in high heels, who stood tall and godlike and whose existence nobody would ever think to burden with an ostensibly immortal piece of bread again, not in a million years. This fantasy sequence ran across my mind screen for almost a minute. Then another bag lady entered the bakery. Her bag accidentally smacked into me and I snapped back into reality. One last time I scanned the bakery for the baker, and there was no baker. I swore out loud so everybody could hear me. Nobody heard me. I swore again, louder, and left. I gathered up my shawl and my hat and my buck teeth and my bag and went home. When I got there, I realized I had not eaten breakfast yet. I hadn't even eaten breakfast in over a month. So I dropped the ostensibly immortal piece of bread into a toaster and waited for it to turn into an ostensibly immortal piece of toast, wondering what it was going to feel like to have the taste of God in my mouth. The end. Well, yeah. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Or... questions or concerns? I appreciate you all coming. I had fun. Yeah.
I can ask a question.
Sure.
So do you
No.
Okay. I
think some of my stories can masquerade in a lot of different genres. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes I'll go to horror conferences that are mainly genre horror writers that go there and, you know, enthusiasts. But my stuff can pass off as that. I call it, you know, irreal fiction, IRREAL, which is a kind of, it's a number of things, but mainly it's narratives that take place in kind of dreamlike atmospheres and that don't, we were talking about this earlier, the cause and effect schema that that exists in these atmospheres are not those that exist, you know, in the world that we all live in. People react to things in different ways, and my characters are able to take many more liberties. And I like doing that sort of thing. It's fun. Yeah. So I mean, you know, you could. I've submitted some stories to like science fiction magazines, for instance, that were. But it doesn't get any. The science fiction. I'm not. As I said before, I'm not much into the machinery, I guess you could say, of science fiction. But yeah, I don't know if that answers the question. Okay. Steven?
Well, I just have one question.
Sure.
A lot of the stories that I've read in that book and some of them in the Cop Effect, one thing aside from like the surreal element that seems to combine a lot of these tales and meditations together is there seems to be an undercurrent, or in some cases an overtone of violence. And I'm just curious how it is that has manifested itself in so many of your works and why.
Hanging out with you, brother. I don't know. The violence that I employ, I mean, it's cartoon violence for the most part, and the nature of the modern world. But no, it's, as I said before, I say a lot that I don't take myself seriously, or I don't take my writing too seriously. I'm serious about the writing that I do, but, you know, it allows me to play with a lot of things, this type of stuff. And one of those things is violence. And I don't know. In that context, I don't think the violence that I write is all that threatening. If you approach it from if you don't approach it from a serious angle. That's not your question. I'm skirting around your question. I don't know. You know, Daddy beat me? No, not at all. I don't know. I'm not sure. Do you have a question, Tim?
I do have a question.
Yeah. Mr. Bowen.
Thank you. I was going to comment a little bit about the characters.
Mm-hmm.
In your, there seems to be some similarities between each one. They don't get their identity through love, it seems like, through loss, mm-hmm. Pain, passion, to a certain extent. And in this dreamlike world,
right.
Where is this identity coming from? Is it sort of, I was thinking mass mediated world, but then you mentioned the dreamlike world, and how does that sort of come together then?
Yeah.
The identity of these characters?
Well, generally speaking, the world that we live in, we live on a kind of diet of fiction, and the sort of image culture that produces us. And I'm very firm believer in that, and I do try to represent that in my stories to varying degrees. I'm not sure that's quite what you're asking. There's a lot of impersonators in my stories, and people dressing them up in various ways. Whether it be with personalities, costumes, all kinds of different things. And I am I'm very interested in, I think society is very performative and that we perform a lot for each other. And then we're encouraged to do that by things like the mass media. And I try to represent that in extreme ways in my fiction. Yeah. Anything else? Todd? This is going to be a hard... Don't do it. Don't do like a Derridian reading or ask me that. I'm not going to be able to answer it.
No, it's relatively simple. I'm struck by... you have a lot of themes that remind me of Borges. And I'm kind of curious when you started playing with ideas. I mean, questions about...
Mm-hmm.
Epistemology, right? When are we going to get to the real person, right?
What did I tell you? Go on, I'm sorry. Keep going.
This emphasis on God, right? Which is
Yeah.
What would it be like to be God?
Right.
And this guy, this last word in particular, you had this guy who's a deconstructionist, and that would horrify him. There's a piece of bread that is immortal.
Right.
And, you know, kind of mocks it. Which just, there's that great Talani part of Borges Tortue's
story. Borges' story.
Yeah, Borges' story, in which there's a mirror, right, mocking Borges because, you know, mirrors reflect eternally, et cetera.
Right.
What is my question? Yeah, my question has to do with, you were writing this stuff before you read Borges.
I read Borges, yeah. I was reading Borges before I started publishing stuff anyway. But yeah, I was thinking about that. I don't really deliberate God that much. It just so happened that those were the two stories that the Disney reanimated in, and Sensibly Immortal Piece of Bread, where I did. But I am very interested in narcissism and the way in which, seriously, and the way in which narcissism manifests itself in different people. Because it does manifest itself in a lot of different ways. And it intrigues me, and it also entertains me very much. And so, you know, part of the reason I write is to entertain myself, too. So it gives me an outlet to do that. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There was a particular line you mentioned about even people of the third world were buying.
Right.
Everyone has a parrot that they were doing. And I kind of see a vexed relationship, especially with the image of the parrot, which stands so much for colonial mimicry.
Right.
And here is the third world really buying into this authoritarian professor's substitution of the self through a parrot, but then. Most countries in the third world really had that kind of authoritative pattern, much more intensified than you find in the American Academy in the first place, because of the colonial hangover right there. Am I making?
Yeah. At no point. Yeah, I mean, when I put that in there to be funny.
Yeah.
I don't think there are pet stores on every corner in, you know, wherever.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, kind of draw attention.
Right, right.
Whether, you know, because there are so many political echoes going on, resonances going on there.
Yeah, I didn't think about that when I was writing them.
Actually, I was just going to ask if there was anything that you thought of adding to that piece of toast once it came out of the toaster, the character's going to get plain.
I'll tell you what. I could not end that story. And that story was supposed to be a couple of pages long, and it kept going on and on. The ending of that is just my inability to be able to end it, really. I went through many revisions, and yeah. What did you suggest?
I would go for a little butter and cinnamon sugar on it.
Okay. Yeah, Kyle.
Now, every once in a while, I drift off, so I might have just missed something.
Uh-huh.
But in that last story, it seemed to me like the narrator could have actually been the baker. Were you intending that? Or?
There are, in terms of the baker being this kind of focal figure around which that reality is sort of structured, that's what sort of facilitates the protagonist's desire in that capacity.
I
so I was trying to link them like that.
But I was wondering if was saying that it was, that this is his fault. It was sort of implying that.
That it's the protagonist's fault?
Yeah. Wasn't there a point where he was basically implicating him for his
problems right.
that he had with the bread? And
right, sure, sure.
Well,
yeah. Clearly, the protagonist is screwy, and I mean, if you get rid of all of the sort of dreamy, weird things that are going on, I mean, basically, we're just dealing with a kind of insecure guy who wants some recognition. And I often start out with characters like that and try to build worlds around them. Yeah, but I did try to equate his sort of ontology with that of the Bakers. Yeah. Well, thank you all for coming. I appreciate it. I had fun.